Winter thrills await at Winterfest at Nemacolin. Join the fun on Saturday, February 10th for a day of fun-fueled winter festivities like skiing and snowboarding, snow tubing, ice skating, and snow bikes. You'll be able to meet the Nemacolin Dogs Sled Team, try your hand at ice bowling, compete in the out-cold race, and finish your day with a brew by the fire at the peak. A winter of wonders waiting for you at Nemacolin's Winterfest. Experiences are for overnight guests and members. For more information, visit nemacolin.com.
This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Welcome to Green Pulse, a podcast series by The Straits Times where we analyze the beats of the changing environment, from biodiversity conservation to climate change. I'm your host, Audrey Tan, and I cover science and environment for The Straits Times. My co-host is David Fogarty.
Hi, I'm David, and I'm the climate change editor at The Straits Times.
It is the 13th of January. Today we break down a term that's often bandied about in climate change discussions, adaptation. This was a key issue at the United Nations Climate Change Conference COP26 in Glasgow last November. We speak to Dr. Arjuna Dibley, a researcher at the Oxford Sustainable Law Programme and a co-author of a recent UN report on adaptation. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Arjuna.
Thanks for having me, Audrey. It's great to be here.
So I was wondering if you could clarify the term for us. What exactly does adaptation mean in climate change discourse, and why is it so important?
Yeah, it's a great question, Audrey. I mean, to understand the concept of adaptation, I think it's important for us to take a step back and understand what the latest climate science is telling us. So as you know, climate change is really referring to the set of physical consequences which follow from the annual growth in greenhouse gas emissions. As emissions go up, global average temperature goes up, and as those temperatures increase annually, our formerly stable and predictable climate, which has really underpinned human societies and human flourishing for centuries, enabling us to grow crops, access water, safely travel, all of that will be subject to a lot less predictability. And as you know, we're already facing increasingly severe weather events, whether they be hurricanes or cyclones and droughts. And unfortunately, the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the global body that is responsible for climate science, is telling us that we're on a trajectory where these risks will continue to increase in severity and frequency. For Singapore and the region that surrounds you and your listeners, you know, this poses serious threats to food security, water security, and ongoing threats to human health. So this is why adaptation is important and where adaptation comes in, because climate change is already happening now. And so as societies, we need to take steps to respond to those climate changes. And it's a broad concept. It really refers to the social, economic, and ecological steps which are needed to respond to this changing climate. It can include processes or practices and structures that might limit the potential damage or to benefit from the opportunities of climate change. So this can include everything from ensuring governments have better disaster risk preparedness responses in place, through to building flood levees or carrying out preventative fire management. And these steps, as I said, are important because they enable countries and communities and all of us really to survive and thrive under these different changed climatic conditions.
So I wonder if you could give us some more examples of adaptation. You've just given us a few, but of course they differ from city to city and country to country depending on the circumstances.
Yes, of course, David. It's a very good point. Adaptation, you know, activities happen at multiple levels, and as you say, they vary from location to location. And indeed, adaptation strategies ought to vary according to the set of hazards and risks. To give an example that might be relevant for your listeners in Singapore, you know, obviously as a low-lying city state, you might face considerable risks from rising sea levels. As such, as I understand, the Singapore government has already expended considerable effort in adapting to future coastal inundation, including significant investments to protect your critical infrastructure like seaports and your airport. Those types of risks are not obviously the same in different regions. So in the Middle East, for instance, the preparedness might need to be around increased loss of water access, so water security issues, And of course, in different regions, the risks will differ again. The other point I'd make there is that, you know, oftentimes we think of adaptation as being a government-led activity. And indeed, the example I gave was of governments. But adaptation activities are not just limited to governments. Communities can also take steps. Businesses can also take steps to respond. So, for example, ensuring that they have sufficient risk-sharing mechanisms like in insurance policies to respond to what the future climate will look like in their region. This is a responsibility not just for governments, but for businesses and communities as well.
Thanks, Arjuna. And I do want to come back to your point about how adaptation measures can be community-led. So are there any estimates for what adapting to climate change could cost?
The question of cost, I think, is so important because it underpins our motivations oftentimes. And I think for a very long time, economists who have been studying climate change have been telling us a fairly consistent message, which is that the costs of responding to climate change, and that means reducing the risk, reducing emissions, those costs are they seem very high, but they're less than the actual costs of adaptation once we are in a changed climate. But there are estimates. So to give you an example, the UN Environmental Programme, for instance, estimated in 2016 that the annual costs of adaptation in developing countries alone could be between $140 billion and $300 billion by 2030. But sorry, that's an annual cost. So between $140 billion and $300 billion. And, you know, with increasing levels of climate change, the annual costs might increase to between $280 billion and $500 billion by 2050. So this is for developing countries only on an annual basis. And what's more, since 2016, when these figures were produced, more research has emerged estimating these climate costs, suggesting that the costs would be at the higher end of those estimates that were originally developed several years ago. The costs are large is the main point. But I guess the second point is that although these numbers seem very significant, the opportunity actually exists now to try and prevent the costs being as significant as they are by reducing emissions. So while we're here talking about adaptation, I think it's really important to highlight this point that adaptation and mitigation are inherently linked, and that the more effort we expend today to reduce emissions, the less likely we are to face risks and the very severe costs in the future.
Going back to the point about how adaptation can be costly, if that's the case, how do communities cope? Like if it's not a government-led initiative, how would smaller communities be able to deal with the impacts?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the absence of government-led activity, oftentimes the costs today do fall on communities. And this is often the case in countries that are in poor countries and highly climate vulnerable countries where the costs of an already changed climate are being faced by communities. So, for example, you might think of a region that's been experienced severe cyclones for many years. You know, in those communities that have suffered property damage or property loss, if they don't have insurance and in the absence of a government support mechanism, they have to pay the costs to rebuild houses if they're damaged, for example. So some communities, I think, are responding to these risks. They're trying to understand them themselves and they're trying to take action either individually or on their own. So I can give you an example from my country, Australia. As you know, we had very severe forest fires, bushfires here in 2019 and 2020, what scientists refer to as a mega fire. And following that event, you know, there's been increased focus at all different levels. You know, governments and businesses and communities have become much more alive to fire risk and the very significant nature of fire risk under a increasingly a changed climate and what that might look like. So communities have been, among other things, working on communications plans. So if for some very remote communities, for instance, have been developing plans so that in case there is another significant fire, they can communicate with one another and warn people in the community that a fire is approaching. So that's just one very small example, but these are the types of things that I think at a community level that can be done.
Find us on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or via the Google Voice Assistant and Amazon Alexa-enabled devices. And now back to our podcast episode.
Discussions on adaptation have been going on for many years. Maybe give us a sense of where things stand now. There was lots of talk about adaptation at COP26, for example. What were some of the key issues of disagreement and perhaps emerging agreement that we might see later on?
In many ways, you know, adaptation is the poorer cousin to mitigation in those forums. There are many reasons, I think, for that. It's easier, I think, for governments and for businesses to understand the outcome of mitigation. So a ton of emission reductions by replacing a coal plant with a renewable energy plant is something that's perhaps easier to understand than the avoided cost of future climate change, which sometimes is a little more abstract. I think also there's been, for a long time, sitting behind the negotiations has been a view that focusing too heavily on adaptation might create some perverse incentives for the mitigation goal. So to put that in another way, if parties are too prepared for a changed climate, they may have less incentive to try and prevent that future from occurring. Now, I don't think we're in that world anymore. I think for some of the examples I've given in this discussion so far, like the major Australian bushfires, we're seeing fires in Siberia for the first time. These really significant events have really, I think, brought home the fact that the COP negotiations really need to focus a lot more on adaptation, and the significance of this issue, I think, is rising. Having said that, there are still a number of really key issues, including at COP26. Perhaps the most significant one that often is discussed is about what's referred to as the $100 billion goal. So in 2009, the International Climate Negotiations in Copenhagen, there was an agreement of the parties then that wealthy countries, rich countries, would provide developing countries with $100 billion per annum in adaptation finance. But over the past 13 years, since the 2009 Copenhagen event, this hasn't yet come to fruition. And so this is a hotly contested issue because really some analysts today, estimate that really the $100 billion number is nowhere near sufficient. And we're not even there yet. Every passing year, I think, when the significance of adaptation becomes clearer and clearer, this will become a more hotly contested issue. And related to that, some of the other issues that flow from that. So what do we mean by adaptation? What would be counted within that $100 billion is still something which has been left unclear. So these are some of the central debates that are ongoing at the COP level.
On that note, you were also an author of a report looking at the adaptation gap that was released during COP26. Maybe tell us a bit more about what adaptation gap means and what were some of the key findings from that report?
Yeah, well, thank you for plugging the report, Audrey. The UN Environmental Programme has an annual report, which is called the Adaptation Gap Report. It's the sibling to the annual Emissions Gap Report, which is published every year. And this has been happening since the 20th Conference of the Parties of the 20th COP in Lima in 2014. And really, I think, highlights, as I was saying before, the increasingly growing interest in adaptation and the importance of it. But basically, the Adaptation Gap Report, or the AGR for short, considers three key issues: adaptation financing, so that's what we've been talking about, the costs of effectively adapting; adaptation planning, which really refers to the adequacy of government plans to prepare for changes, climate change, and then implementation processes, so studying how effectively adaptation projects are being implemented on the ground.
But other than support in terms of financial flows, what are other ways that developed nations can contribute to helping developing countries adapt to climate impacts?
Yeah, it's a good point. And it might be worth just reiterating the reason we talk so much about finance, I think, is because of, I guess, there's a moral question that really sits behind this, which is, and it's been a present feature of the UN negotiations on climate change since the beginning, which is that wealthy countries, for the most part, have achieved high levels of economic development through highly polluting industries. And developing countries are now being asked to achieve economic development through other technologies which are less polluting. And so a lot of the climate change that we're already experiencing is baked in because of the economic growth that occurred from wealthy countries. So that's why finance, I think there's this moral case for finance. And I'm saying that because I think finance is really important, and I think it needs to be the center of the response. But your question was about, you know, moving beyond finance. So I think beyond finance, there are many things that can be provided. So a lot of the support, or a lot of the issues that face developing countries right now relate to technical questions of understanding, you know, what climate change will mean for their particular country, and for particular sectors within that country. And this requires a level of technical expertise which can be better shared, I think. So there's a financial component to that, obviously, but I think there's, you know, there is a lot of technical expertise in wealthy countries, and that knowledge could be shared more effectively. Another thing that could be done is in terms of knowledge development. So some of these questions of how does climate change affect a particular region are understudied, because unfortunately a lot of research that's produced tends to focus on wealthy countries and not as much on developing countries. So more could be done in terms of knowledge production as well, to build that knowledge base to allow, you know, governments and businesses and others to be more prepared, I guess, for the climate damages that are unfortunately in the future.
So, Arjuna, just as a final question, as climate impacts increase, adaptation will become increasingly more challenging in many places, meaning there's a limit to how much some places can adapt. So how do you see things changing over the next year, particularly in the run-up to COP27 in Egypt?
Yes, David, that's a great point, and it's a really important point. Climate risks differ in different regions, as we talked about before. But for all risks, there is an upper limit of what natural ecosystems that sustain us can tolerate and what individuals and societies will tolerate. And these risk tolerances really represent the upper limit after which it's necessary to change or move or unfortunately perish. So that's a slightly abstract concept, but let me try and illustrate that with an example. So, you know, rice production is very significant in the region that you're sitting in, Southeast Asia, and rice pollination occurs optimally at a nighttime temperature of around 26 degrees. And scientists have told us that with about a 10% decline in yield for every increase in 1 degree of temperature. So as the temperatures increase year on year, rice production is likely to decrease. And up to a certain point, and there's a biological limit after which pollination can't continue. But before we even reach that point, it's likely you can imagine the economic systems might lead to a drop-off in production. As nighttime temperatures increase over time, which is predicted in climate models, rice production will decrease to a point where it may be uneconomic to be a rice farmer, to export rice. And this is a really important point, because our, you know, society and economies may bring on certain tipping points much sooner than ecological limits. So I provide this example to your listeners because, you know, the significance of this example will be immediately apparent to them. You know, rice obviously has massive economic value in Southeast Asia, but it also has very significant cultural significance. I mean, imagine a world without nasi lemak. Like, that's a poorer world, I think. And so, you know, as businesses, as investors, as governments start to become more engaged in thinking about climate change as a risk issue and understanding what the future means, understanding what it means for particular sectors of the economy. As that crystallizes, I think I'm optimistic that we will all start taking this issue a lot more seriously. In COP27, it's being hosted in Egypt. Africa is obviously a region that is disproportionately affected by climate impacts at the moment. So I'm hoping that being in that setting, negotiators will increase the significance of adaptation even higher.
Well, thanks for joining us on our podcast today, Arjuna, to explain adaptation and what it means and how important it is.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you both.
Great. Thanks so much. It was really good.
Well, that's a wrap for Green Pulse, and we hope you enjoyed our discussion. For more on climate change and the environment, do check out our stories in the Straits Times. And don't forget to subscribe to our Green Pulse podcast series on your favorite audio apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts.
That was a podcast by the Straits Times. Send your feedback to podcast@sph.com.sg. Find us on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or via the Google Voice Assistant and Amazon Alexa-enabled devices. For more podcasts by The Straits Times, The Business Times, and Money FM 89.3, you can also download the Audio by SPH app. That's AWEDIO.
If your air conditioning or furnace stops working in the middle of the night, on a weekend, or over a holiday, there's no reason to wait to get it fixed. Because Atlas Butler's always open, and we never charge any overtime or after-hours fees.
The Atlas Butler family is here to keep your family safe and comfortable. Call today, get it fixed today. That's our pledge to you. Atlas Butler.